Scutton, Bread and Beer, or Metheglin? If you have to drink a drink from this world, what do you drink?
Okay, so Metheglin is something that's kind of...
Metheglin actually exists.
Right.
That's the one caveat, is Metheglin actually exists.
And what is it
again? It's a mead. It's like a super, super sweet mead.
Ooh, super sweet?
Yes, it is a very sweet mead.
Well, no, never mind. I got like an instant headache just imagining. Okay. And bread and beer is like just heavy, thick beer.
Yeah, it's... The joke that Simon and Will make is that it contains so many trace nutrients that pregnant women drink it, and it's like chewing your beer. Ugh. It's like a meal in a bottle.
I don't like heavy beer either. Yeah. So then the third one,
Scutton is a though they don't necessarily use the word dry, but the way I think of it is like a super, super dark, dry, tannin-forward red wine.
Okay. I mean, I don't like tannin-forward, but of the three,
they
that
never
seems
say
the
that,
most...
That's how I think of it.
Okay. That's probably what I'll go with, because when I get super full on beer, I just go sleep. I don't feel great.
You do.
I don't feel great. So bread and beer, I'm just not gonna... I mean, I get the appeal. I can't do it. And Metheglin, as much as I love mead, I don't want it to be super saccharine.
Sure.
I can't do really sweet drinks because those give me headaches. I have a very delicate constitution. I don't know if I've made that clear enough.
Well.
But I'll go Scutton.
Okay. Scutton.
Metheglin.
The drink of kings. For Ashley, as Will would describe it, Metheglin.
See, okay, and it's Will, of course. He and I just vibe.
Yeah, see, I told you this like three episodes ago.
I know.
So, Kyle, you're Metheglin because you love mead. This a super, super long cut back to episode one, where we actually drank mead when we
that was a good
recorded.
Day. That was a good day.
It was a long time ago.
It was a long time ago and far, far away.
Guys, I don't know if you know this, but we've been friends for a long time. Everyone celebrate our friendship. Thanks.
Yes, please.
See, what's great is we do have like one of those big anniversaries coming up soon, and it might be great to maybe have some meat again in celebration, or maybe
Don't
something
tempt
else.
Me
it
like
just
that.
Depends.
Don't cool tempt me like that.
I mean, I don't know if to tempt you. There's a bunch of great like beverage like stores around here, and mead is sold. Can confirm.
Okay, you've talked me into it. I'm all for it. Let's go drink mead.
The rhetoric is impeccable.
Right?
For me, I think I would probably go with Scutton as well.
Because, really?
So, I only like super heavy beer in the winter.
Which we are...
We are heading towards, but the winter in Tennessee is not exactly what I would call winter.
It's ice storms.
Oh, South Dakota's already had its first winter.
Yeah, that's astounding to me. I feel
two
like...
2 feet of snow, it's great. I got stuck in a town for 2 days.
I just imagine...
Because of snow.
I just imagine that South Dakota is really just Stephen King's The Dome, except it's a snow globe. You guys are in a snow globe. And every once in a while, God just shakes it.
Yep.
So and then it picks like, up South Dakota, mud gives a little shake. Goes, hey, yep. Oh, pretty.
I'm not going to, I don't know why, but for some reason I swore you were about to say that it basically is Fargo.
Well, okay, so no. No, I was not going to say
that. Too far north.
Yeah. And I don't think I've not gotten serial killer vibes from Kyle.
Little do you know.
Nor do I get like paying off serial killer vibes from Kyle. He just seems to be a rather upstanding gentleman. I don't know what
don't
friend
beg
you're
me
thinking
like that.
Of.
I mean, that's fair. But yes, I'm going to choose Scutton. I have gotten more into whiskey and wine in the past couple of years than I have beer.
Ah, yes, the W's.
Yes, the glorious W's. And like I'm starting to like different types of wine. Like, for instance, we bought Bordeaux recently, and I've been...
But you have been fantasizing about Bordeaux since we've been married.
It's true. But also, good Bordeaux we've never been able to afford. So being able to do that now and
I'm
enjoy it...
I'm still not convinced that Costco Bordeaux is quote-unquote good Bordeaux.
Hey, look. I mean... Look. Don't do me like that. It's fine. It's tasty wine. Why you gotta be like that?
A truth teller? I don't know.
Says the woman who's enjoyed the wine we've had.
Yes, I have. In small amounts, with cheese. I think maybe it's the cheese I've enjoyed.
You are from Wisconsin.
Yeah. I know my trade.
Hello, everyone. This is episode 198 of the MinMax podcast. Hope this finds you all well. Guys, we are two away from 200. It doesn't seem possible that we're almost there, but sure enough, we are. And I mean, technically speaking, with all of the D&D episodes, we're well past it. But canonically speaking, we are at 198.
That's just insane to me.
We nearly have, like, we're a few episodes short because of all the travel that we've done over the past couple of years. So, like, 4 years of episodes would be 208, and we're about to hit 200. Did I say 2 years? I meant 4 years. 4 years of episodes would be 208.
But we're having so much fun, it feels like, too, is what he means.
It does seem a little bit crazy that it's been 4 years since we were in our second apartment and Kyle living 5 minutes away. It seems like a lifetime ago.
We do leave a wake of heartbreak. It's true.
Truly. Just devastation everywhere.
So we are continuing our series on the King Killer Chronicle, Patrick Rothfuss's fantasy series, one of my favorite books. And we have now set the cast mostly. We'll hit a few more characters on our way through. But we thought that after all of this setup, discussing villains, discussing our favorite peoples, discussing the world, the map, that we would begin to make our way through this wonderful work and talk about the story. So, shall we begin at the beginning?
You mean the thing we've been avoiding doing since the beginning of this whole series?
Yes, exactly.
Sure.
How do you guys find the identical opening and closing of book one?
Well, we kind of touched on that when we first started, and I actually really... really love that.
Despite it breaking like so many different writing rules.
What writing rules does it break?
Just like colloquially speaking, like you don't do tons of repetition. You don't use tons.
According to who?
You don't use like tons of. I'm quoting Rothfuss, like in his foreword of like doing all the things that you say not to do. 90% of the book is backwards.
Yeah, I've never heard that advice.
I feel like writers just say, screw that, I'm going to do whatever the hell I want.
But I've never heard that advice, though.
Right.
I think he's making stuff up to make himself look like a rebel. I don't buy that. Rothfuss,
like
explain yourself.
Rothfuss.
So you guys, generally speaking, you like the silence of three parts.
Yeah, I think that's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really beautiful. And I think that, I think frankly, in, you know, of all of the different fantasy fiction we've talked about in this podcast that exist throughout the world, like having something like that, having a feature like that really helps break a reader who is seasoned in fantasy fiction. I feel like it helps separate it as something other, and it is fantasy fiction, but it makes it stand out in a way and highlights the themes of the type of story he's trying to tell much better than some series that feel just kind of perpetually open-ended. Like, it's very clear he's telling one set, defined, limited story.
Yeah.
He's not going to be going on and on and on and on and on forever. But there is a specific theme at play here.
Yeah, I get that. And that there's always, like, no matter how far the story goes abroad, no matter which different places of the four corners we visit, you end in an inn. You end with the quiet cut flower sound of a man waiting to die.
Yeah.
And Coat is there waiting for you. Not Quoth, Coat. Kyle, what about you? Any interesting thoughts on kind of the opening and then the subsequent closing?
Not really anything specific beyond that. I mean, I tend to agree. I like the way it kind of end caps things. I also like the way he throws kind of pieces of variation into it, you know, with book two and things like that. So yeah. It kind of maintains the structure, but at the same time kind of evolves in a way, right?
Yeah.
Like, as you're moving through the narrative and in just very small and subtle ways. And I do like the way that he does that a lot.
Yeah, it's funny because I've talked to other friends who are really into fantasy fiction and they're kind of ambivalent about Rothfuss for the moment. And I don't know if it's they're just jumping on board the train of like George R. R. Martin, where no, calm down, stop. This is not
a book in 10
no,
years.
Stop. This is not your opening to be a about this. Okay. What I'm saying is, whether it's that or they just can't get into his writing style,
sure.
One persistent description that's come up is that it's very literary to them.
Sure.
Which I find an interesting descriptor because they're comparing it to other fantasy fiction they've read.
Sure.
And I don't know necessarily how to interpret that. And it just makes me wonder what about fantasy fiction overall, especially, I guess, like American written or North American written fantasy fiction.
Sure.
Has a specific quality to it that Kingkiller Chronicle does not embody in some way, that it makes it quote unquote literary.
Yeah. So, and I'm not going to try to get on my high horse here, so I will attempt to not mount this horse, but it's, I do have some thoughts on that. At least for me, a lot of American fantasy fiction, the writing is more utilitarian. They don't play with language for the sake of language.
Sure.
Very often.
I would say that's fair in a lot of ways.
And
which
I think
I don't like.
Yeah, exactly. And like, I'm going to pull in someone who Ashley dislikes, who does this in the same way.
I was
going
to do this, yeah.
You know where I'm going with this.
Correct.
The same crowd that likes Patrick Rothfuss is the same crowd, and the way that he plays with language is going to be the same crowd that likes Aaron Sorkin, and the way that he crafts like these
this is
fictional
not the
narratives. Oh, you didn't.
No, this is not the direction.
He plays he plays with words in the same way. Like, what I mean by that is he unashamedly loves using good words and, like, not being afraid.
Unlike other writers. He's not like other writers.
They
don't like playing with words.
They aren't afraid.
He eats pizza and listens to punk rock. He's not like those other writers.
What I mean by that,
eat salad, drink pumpkin spice lattes,
is merely that they both enjoy playing with literary language and making words and phrases sound lyrical, which is actually a common comment. Both of you need to grow up.
Oh, I can't help it. You're just digging yourself a hole, and it's great.
No, I'm not. I am holding the line, and I am not mounting this horse, because if I mount this horse, this podcast is going to go into a whole different direction.
Please stop saying you're not mounting the horse.
Fine, I'm getting up on my high horse. I have mounted the horse. This is now your fault.
Oh, it hurts.
Oh my god.
All I was meaning to say is that I enjoy the way that they play with the English language and that they aren't afraid to make their lyrics feel and flow like music, which is a descriptor that's used of both of them. Rothfuss,
your
like
lyrics?
Lyrical. That's
I know what lyrical is. Don't you dare mansplain.
I wasn't trying to mansplain.
I didn't know if you meant because Sorkin doesn't write lyrics.
No, but he writes in a lyrical fashion. There's a beat. There's a syncopation to
yes,
it.
I
there's
understand
a cadence.
That, but he doesn't write lyrics. He writes lines.
Correct.
That's why I was confused
Sorry.
When you were referring to their lines as lyrics.
Sorry. They write in a lyrical style. There's a musical feel to it. When you read it aloud, it was felling night and the usual crowd had gathered at the Waystone Inn. Five wasn't much of a crowd, but five was as many as the Waystone Inn ever saw these days. Like, there's a
well
cadence
I don't know if that's
to how
a
it
great
rolls.
Example.
It's not the best one. It's just the first line of the first chapter.
Right, but you could have gone with the actual
yes,
lyrical
could've.
Portions of the book.
I could have if I was reaching, but even in that, there isn't...
The whole point is for you to reach to give us a quality example.
For goodness sake, I was not prepared for this particular argument in this particular...
Look, you brought Sorkin into it. This was your choice. You did this.
What I'm meaning to say is that there is like a strong rhythmic syncopated way that the lines flow. And that's not always true of all North American fantasy authors. Fair. Kyle. Fair.
I guess I would say he just has a very strong rhetorical style. I don't know that I would go so far as to call it lyrical. Like, at times, certainly. And in a lot of ways, certainly. I just think he's very careful and intentional about his rhetoric. And I think that is very valuable. Like, that's something that struck me very early on, is just, like, the rhetoric and his word choice and the way that he kind of crafts of sentences and things like that. I feel like it's very well done. And like I said, certainly lyrical at certain times and places, but I just think in general, I just think he's an exceptional writer in terms of his writing style and his clarity and like the way he comes across and things like that.
Yeah, that's fair. So after we get through the opening sequence of the three silences, mm-hmm. we are introduced to a few characters who we actually haven't touched on yet. The characters of the Waystone Inn and the regulars at the Waystone Inn. So you've got Shep, you've got not Crazy Martin. He's the scientist who's doing crazy things like putting a well inside of his house.
I love it. That's
Jake,
just engineering.
Cobb.
Modern engineering.
Yeah, exactly. I will say that is one element that I do love that he inserts, that Crazy Martin is doing things that are just
like
absolutely
plumbing.
Insane. Like putting a bathroom in your house. The audacity. The insanity. planting barley. Crazy Martin likes his spirits. That's my working theory. You plant barley, you can make whiskey. End of story.
Smart man. That's one you'd want to befriend, frankly.
Yes. So we've got Old Cobb, Graham, Jake, Shep. So Cobb being the old storyteller who's a pretty crap storyteller.
Right.
But there's a charm in that somehow.
There is. There is the one guy. It is interesting that in this tiny microcosm that Rothfuss sets up of Coat, the bumbling barkeep, and his very strange apprentice, Bast.
Who turns on, like, every single woman he encounters in this town.
Yeah, Bast with a charisma score of 12 on the 10 scale. And then they're greeted multiple times a week, sometimes a day, by the crowd that comes to get their, presumably, lunch and dinner at the inn on a semi-regular basis. Mm-hmm. So you've got Graham and Jake, who are, they give off like the friend vibe, like they grew up together. And then you have the Smith's apprentice that is just referred to until most of the way through this book as boy.
Right.
You don't learn his name until after the fight near the end of the book. What do you guys think of kind of that crowd?
Oh, just sounds like people I grew up with. Like, if we had specifically just one tavern or bar that everyone went to that also served food, I mean, all those people just sound like townies.
Yeah, like, having, again, I know I said this a few episodes ago, but having the context of Scotland and where we were living as kind of a mental backdrop for this, there were the people that you would see. If you picked a local pub mm-hmm. and chose to frequent it, you saw them all the time.
Yeah.
Like, the one that we would go to in St. Andrews frequently, Aikman's, mm-hmm. there were the regulars that you got to know, and you got to be known by the bar staff.
Yeah, no, and well, I kind of love that sense of community. The thing that I'll say that I enjoy as someone who has just been an audiobook listener is, and something that caught me off guard the first time I ever listened to the books, was the fact that the narrator doesn't take on any sort of British accents that you're used to typically hearing in fantasy fiction when it's narrated.
Yep.
For audiobooks. So it is very easy when you're reading it, I think, to just assume a European-centric or British-centric sort of culture. But the way that it's voiced is very American. In fact, like, a couple of the guys that he voices, I'm just like, are they in Boston? Where are they? Like, I remember the right. first time we ever listened to it, I was like, Ellen, where is this placed? I have no clue where we are.
Yeah, that Nick Podell is the guy who does the voice, and the first time I listened to it, I wasn't sure about it. And I don't think it was until the introduction of Kilvin that I really fell in love with him, because it felt like, at first, it was like, there's not a lot of differentiation here. Upon what is now like the 10th or 12th listen, I can hear the subtle variance.
Yeah, it's very nuanced, and I applaud that, because it feels like he's not trying too hard. With some, I feel like the narrator tries so hard. And I've listened to a couple that were, like, especially after we moved back, I'd listened to a couple audiobooks that were set in Scotland, and they were Americans trying to do a Scottish accent, and it was so cringy.
Yeah, no, it's so hard to do. The brogue is just so hard to actually do, let alone any of the different variances of it.
Yeah. So I guess this is unsolicited advice, but if you're a voice actor and you're narrating fantasy fiction and you can choose where it's set, if you can't do decent sort of vocalizations of British accents and dialects, don't try, because we will find you.
So There is an interesting note of the story that Cobb is telling when we're first introduced to the story. And I just kind of want to get your thoughts on it. Do you guys remember what it is? Which of the fantastical stories he's telling?
Isn't it Tamburlaine the Great?
It is the story of Tamburlaine the Great. And it's the story of Tamburlaine the Great being locked away without his key, coin, and candle, knocking on the chest, yelling, Adro, and grabbing them and escaping. With the context of the Waystone Inn, and in essence being a giant wooden box that Quoth is in, that we barely ever see him leave.
Or there is that chest in his room. Maybe he's got Tamburlaine in his own chest. I'm just kidding.
Is he weakened to burning Tamburlaine the Great?
I mean, maybe. That's possible. Could Tamburlaine be referred to as a king? Who's to say?
I'll admit that's not an angle I had considered.
See, I'm going to be honest. I'm not too worried about the context of the story itself. I've just developed a new headcanon in which old Cobb is actually just Manette, but now he's just doing the same thing at the Waystone that he always did at the university. Like, he just got a little cracked, and now he just, like, moved to this small town with Kvothe, and he's just like, don't worry, you know that I can just hang in a place forever. I won't share your secret. And now it's just like, it's just Manette, but he's older now and slightly crazier and can't remember the context of the stories he's trying to tell anymore.
Oh,
it's my new favorite
headcanon.
That's all I care about.
Hysterical.
Write it, Rothfuss. Write it.
I am down for this, this chaos. I will be very curious to see, because we've not actually been introduced to anyone in the peerage of the King event, if they're saving like high British RP for the King event.
Maybe
it would be interesting if they chose to do that.
I would really, I think, appreciate it more if the King event had like a Texan accent.
See, I wasn't sure which way you were going to go, because my brain, as you started this, went with Youper, like an Upper Peninsula of Michigan accent.
No, no, I'm thinking, like, it's like no one from where I'm from or from where my grandparents ended up living ever would have referred to themselves as a king with a straight face. However, I have met enough Texans at this point to know that there are at least a handful that would refer to themselves as a king of something.
I mean, I may have told this story super early on the podcast, but I'll bring it up again. One of my professors in college, his daughter married a Texan, and they were living, I think, in Pennsylvania at the time, and had their child. And no joke, I'm not kidding, prior to their child being born, he produced a Ziploc bag full of dirt that he poured on the floor, so they were born over Texas soil. I'm not kidding.
Y'all are
I
extra
wish...
Like,
okay.
Like, can you imagine, like, upon the birth of mine announced first child, I whip out a bag of cheese curds and throw it on the ground.
You're born over our land's export.
No. No. I as someone who very much would intend to be present at that point, I reject this, and I will actively intervene in any attempt to do so.
Kyle, you
I
have
love
one
you
job.
Too much to let you do
you
something
have one
like
job
that.
For the birth of our first child. And that is to toss in the cheese curds.
You bring the curds.
No. You can't make me.
Watch us.
I will not be a party to this insanity.
We've come a long way from Noir.
Oh, God.
Okay, so Tabitha the Great, we get the brief introduction of Bast, who is just a little bit too good looking and a little bit strange for the Waystone.
So when they eventually either televise or film this, on a scale of 1 to 10, how how Bilbo is Bast going to get when he gets in front of Iron? Like, is he going to pull that creepy face? How are they going to play that?
That is really a good question.
Because they have to thread that needle between being super hot and terrifying.
Honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if they play with the glamour fading and just flickering just a little bit.
Yeah, I guess.
And going a little bit feral and suddenly, like, not being able to hide his form. Like, his nice leather boots don't look like nice leather boots. I wouldn't be shocked if that's the moment, actually, if they're going to film this, that they don't do the corner of the eye thing. Mm-hmm. They do that maybe for a split second, and then Chronicler grabs his ring and says iron and tries to bind him.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's when we see the terrifying form of Bast.
Yeah.
And his cold blue full eyes.
I kind of imagine him, this is a heck of a throwback, but I really liked this movie when it first came out, but Blackheart in the Nick Cage Ghost Rider.
Oh!
Like, the moments where you see him go, like, full devil kind of thing, and he's, like, actually, like, blue-skinned, red-eyed kind of, yeah. Something in that kind of vein.
Okay. Okay.
That's how I imagine in his more terrifying moments, that's what he looks like.
Okay.
It's going to be interesting to see how they interpret that. Like, because he is of the fair folk. Like, that's part of their name. So their glamour, they can make themselves look however they want.
Mm-hmm.
We get that impression that Florian can do the same thing. I'm really curious. I almost picture Bast going somewhere between, like, full black lichen and, like, a cross between, because they describe him as having hooved feet.
Right.
So, like, somewhere between half horse, half lichen is how I think of it in my head.
Oh, see, I was thinking, like a goat man, like a satyr.
That's probably fair. That's probably closer to what it is. And especially with the way they describe his speed, that would also make sense.
Yeah.
But, and the callback of the satyr would be, like, Rothfuss knows what
it
he's doing when he evokes the satyr.
Right.
So that definitely could be the way they choose to go with that. So we get the introduction of that. We then also get the first introduction of Carter. And this, up until now, like, you get the weird silences of the book, of the opening. It's like, okay, whatever. I don't understand, but whatever. You get a relatively normal scene. Like, Bast is just the weird teenager working at the bar.
Mm-hmm.
Coat is just a little, like, a shy barkeep. And then you've got the townies being loud and drunk. And then you have Carter walk in, and he's been, like, what looks to be robbed. He's cut up, he's shaken up. And then everything turns when he puts the bundle on the table, and out rolls this giant iron-hided spidery thing that has killed his horse and nearly killed him.
Mm-hmm.
And I know for me, the first time I read it, that was the moment where I was like, what? Like, what? This whole thing just turned. And then you also get the introduction of touching it with an iron drab, and it cracks and sizzles.
Mm-hmm.
So it's you get multiple things. Like, you get the introduction of a fantastical creature. You get that something dark is loose in the world. Coat knows what it is. Like, that's the first instance that we learn that Coat is more than he seems. because he's just like, they couldn't have come over the mountains. How could they have come over the mountains?
Mm-hmm.
And he knows what it is. Like, it's the first big question mark of everyone going, what? And it kind of sets up the first of the heroic actions that we see in the book. So we move a little bit past that, unless you guys have any other additional thoughts there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it just makes me wonder what could have been suppressing them in the first place, whether that's an actual object or feature, or if that's a people group. And that's what worries me most, I guess.
What could have been suppressing whom?
The Skrull.
Yeah, that's a big question. Where do they come from? Because we don't have an answer to that yet.
Yeah.
We just know that they swarm to a piece of themselves.
It's also just dawning on me, and it feels stupid that it's just dawning on me, but it, like, in the context, I feel like it sort of is, I'll tell you what I mean and then explain why it's weird, but like, it's just now dawning on me that you have the Skrull, and then you have, like, the like zombie soldier guy.
Yep.
And then of course Bast at the end. I'm jumping around obviously later into book, at the end of book one and book two, but it's like, these are just like really weird sequences of events happening in this tavern right now. Right. Like, if you just put those things side by side, it's just like, oh yeah. So they're hanging out at this inn. And then this guy comes in and says, oh, this demon spider thing killed my horse. And then they take care of that. And then, like, the next night, oh, this, like, demon soldier guy came in. Huh. Weird.
Right.
And then Bast is doing Bast things, which is terrifying, but.
Right. It's astounding that anyone keeps coming to this tavern.
Right? Well, that's why it's just like, I'm just putting the pieces together and realizing, wait, if we're just taking the context of the Waystone, this is occurring like in a three-night sequence where it's just like demon spider, demon guy.
Yeah.
What's next? Like demon dragon?
Yeah, like straight up, we get, so the course of the book takes like place over 3 days-ish. At least that's what we're told.
Mm-hmm.
And so 3 days, in essence, 4 nights. Because the first night doesn't count, because that's when we meet Chronicler. That's
right.
After the spider comes into play. Quoth takes 1 night to prepare himself.
Mm-hmm.
So the second full day, so that's 2 sleeps. You get all of book one in the first. You get a second sleep. You get all of book two. And then after the third sleep is where book three picks up. So you've got 4 sleeps total so far from what we know. But yeah, things are escalating very quickly at the Waystone.
Mm-hmm.
Going from not really having much traffic to having a bunch of folks come through, like a traveling party, which you typically don't get, and they describe as being odd, to Quoth being recognized and pegged at the end of the first night.
Right.
Having to drug a patron and act like he's been injured to stay out of sight.
Uh-huh.
And then later that night, the road soldier, who's been possessed by whatever the shapeshifter is, things are moving very quickly from dead to very much alive.
Mm-hmm.
So, after the spider, after they dispose of it, and we get the first kind of sing-songy, bury it in a pit 10x2, Ash and Rowan 2, you get the first of the rhyming rhythmic lyrical sections, doing the kind of sing-songy, oh, this is just a children's song.
Sure.
And you get Quoth saying, you'll be surprised what they hide in children's songs. Because
mm-hmm.
we also
Ring Around the Rosie.
Yeah, exactly. But how many people know that story? Honestly, like, how many people actually know the origin of that story? Yeah, exactly. So you get that. You get the introduction of when the troop comes through, the traveling troop group comes through, the children coming out and singing the Chandrian song. Like, that's the first, this, like, we get a bunch of the lyrical stuff in the first, like, 50 pages, give or take. That there is this method for dealing with demons in the world that is doing all the right things for all the wrong reasons. We don't know what the reasons are. We don't know what the right things actually are. It's just, and I think this is where Rothfuss sets up so many hooks in the first, like, 2.5 chapters. Just like, there is a lot to be unpacked here. And frankly, none of it has been yet. Like, at the end of book two, none of it's been taken care of yet.
Well, and that's what I'm so anxious about with regard to book three, not as far as its release date, but how he's at all going to resolve the every single thing he set up. And I'm sure it's enormous pressure. Like, I don't mean to be, not that he'll ever hear this, but like, I'm not meaning to pile on. I just can't imagine, I can't fathom how one wraps this up neatly in a satisfying way.
How much you want to bet we just get an epic cliffhanger on Kvothe's actual story, and then the rest of the like Waystone Inn narrative just resolves itself, and we just never know. Like, there's just a huge chunk of Kvothe's life that we just miss. Because we're like, oh, crap. Like, demons are attacking the Waystone. We're going to have to skip the last, like, 10 years of my life and just jump ahead, guys, and deal with this thing now.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, I'm going to bed. Goodbye. End book three.
I mean, to be fair, there's precedent. Ugh. So if you think about book two, when Kvothe travels to the mayor's court, there's an entire 21-day period that is omitted short of, I'm going to not be able to quote it directly, so you'll forgive me if I only get bits and pieces of the phrase. That's, it was 11 days. It was supposed to take 11 days. I think it took 16. To where he jumped on the boat. There was a storm. There was piracy. He was drowned. He defended himself. He lost all of his clothing and ended up looking like a street urchin again by the time he arrived in the mayor's court.
That's
all
right.
In all, it was an eventful trip. And that's all of the friggin' explanation we get for an epic tale.
True. Fair. Okay.
So I don't doubt that Rothfuss is just going to close some of these hooks without a ton of explanation, short of darkness was unleashed in the world. Scene. And that's going to account for the Skrail and some of the other demonic entities, quote unquote, in the world.
Which is also interesting because we don't really have any proof that they are demonic, right? Because they're constantly, interestingly enough, despite the fact that we have like actual like proof of the existence of Sayla Fey and things like that, like we don't really have any given, like every time demons come up, they're always like, people believe in demons. That's dumb. Hey, Bast, when's the last time you met your Fey buddies, right? Like, it's like,
yeah.
Like the Fey, sure, no big deal. Demons, that's dumb. Right?
Gosh.
Yeah, and yeah. So the question is whether or not they're demons, whether or not it's the dark factions of the Fey, which I really hope, because he said he's going to write more stories in the world. I would love to get stories of the Fey court, because that's going to be dark and really interesting. Like, I want the narrative of the creation war. Like, there's so much of that would be so interesting to flesh the world out, especially after we get the conclusion of this narrative. Okay, so let's move on to the introduction of Chronicler. So, Kvothe and the priest and everyone else do the thing that they're supposed to do, except the piece that Kvothe breaks off and subsequently pockets. Writes a, if you find this, I'm dead note to Bast, and then goes hunting, only to encounter Chronicler on the road, who's just a bumbling scribe of legendary, like, heraldry.
Mm-hmm.
gets mugged, but is used to getting mugged, so he knows how to hide money, so he can still survive.
Yeah, see, that's something I find curious. Like, why is he used to getting mugged?
Right? This poor guy.
In what manner of travel?
This is just Tuesday.
Yeah. In what manner of travel does he get constantly mugged? How has he not created a system apart from just hiding his money? What has happened to this world where he's constantly mugged? Because we see Quoth, like, travel miles upon miles, and we only get, like, a handful of muggings?
Yeah.
Unless he's just being hyperbolic, because he can be.
I mean, he could be. He could be building up his own legend, but the way... when we're,
because that's the legacy you want to leave. I'm mugged constantly, kids.
When we're introduced to Chronicler, it is like of his own perspective. So it's not Quoth telling the story, it's it happening to Chronicler.
Right.
So it's one of the few times we get a narrative that's not Quoth's.
Sure.
In the book.
It's also offset in time, because that's like quote unquote present day, right? When
right.
Chronicler's getting mugged, so it's after the roads have gotten quote unquote bad.
Well,
you
yeah,
know, that phrase that they use all the time, like, oh yeah, the roads are bad, the roads are bad, you know, kind of thing. So kind of like I can see, like, okay, it kind of implies now that this war that we know nothing about is happening, sure, maybe muggings are significantly more frequent.
Yeah, yeah,
but
the roads are bad.
Still,
they're covered in 6 inches of muggings.
Uphill both ways.
Okay, so Chronicler gets mugged, but not all of his money's found, because he secretly keeps some in his boot, in his bread, and in his bottle of ink. But just enough. And you must keep just enough in your purse to not make them get greedy and start searching for more. Says something about his state of mind and general disconnect from the world.
Yeah.
He meets Quoth by chasing a fire into the woods, and then we get the first instance of a heroic action taken by Quoth and then Bast later's description of the Skrail is typically enough to kill one person, one of them. But when you kill five single-handedly, it's the thing of legend. At least according to Bast.
Yeah, but Bast is kind of a hype man, let's be honest.
Yeah,
and he's trying to, yeah, and he's trying to hype Coat. Let's just play with the charade. He's trying to hype his man up. He's trying to, like,
true,
get him out there again. So it wouldn't shock me if Bast had learned some bardic inspiration from his own master.
That's fair.
Ereshi. And is trying to use it against him. Or in his favor, depending on your perspective.
Depending on your perspective. Especially since we know Bast has been sending out messages in a bottle.
Exactly. That, yep.
Yeah, I still don't know what category to put Bast in. Whether he's just trying to hype Quoth up, or if he is a villain in disguise. I don't know which way to go.
I don't think he's a villain. I don't think Rothfuss would write short stories and novellas about the villains.
Sure.
And to be clear, Bast's short story was in a short story anthology about rogues, not villains.
Yeah, the Lightning Tree.
Yeah. So the worst I feel like I could sort of categorize him would be like chaotic neutral.
That's fair.
Yeah. It is in his best interest to hype Quoth up.
Yeah, I'm still trying to... We don't know enough about the Fae yet to know where he's from, other than that he's a Fae prince. And I know I had... for the longest time, I had the running thought that maybe he's actually Quoth's son by Flurion. that came to find him because, again, Fey time's different than real than human time. He crossed into the world through the Gray Gates. That was my working theory for a while, but I don't think it holds up.
Yeah, I don't know. We don't know fairy gestation periods.
Nope.
That would also be frustratingly tropey for,
yeah,
for Robin.
It would.
I feel like, you know, I'm just like, really? Really?
Yeah.
We're going to use that plot device? Like, pregnancy is a plot device. I'm sorry. Don't.
Yeah.
Just don't. Because it's so old at this point.
Agreed.
It is. And I don't disagree with you whatsoever. I don't think it hold. That was like the first time through or the second time through when,
sure,
I was beginning to formulate my own crackpot theories. That was my first, like, my first one. And I was like, no, no, that's really not a good theory.
Yeah.
It's not a good one.
Be so frustrating.
It would be frustrating. So we get the introduction of Chronicler, the author of famed biographies of Orin Velsitor and historic tomes of a scientific nature of the mating habits of the common Dracus. And we assume more. He's
a one-hit wonder with the mating rituals of the coming Dracus.
Yeah, and we know he interviewed Orin Velsitor, and it only took 3 days.
And why is that significant again?
Velsitor is regarded as, like, think like Tamerlane the Great. Like, he lived more life in a few years in his, like, 80 years than most people live in, like, 150. Like, he saw lots of things. He lived lots of different lives. He was just, like, a very storybook, just megalomaniac is not the right word, but it's, like, magnanimous character, just very vibrant and very adventurous. So he did a ton of living in a short period of time, and yet that only took 2 days, is my memory. That's why he's so appalled when Quoth says it's going to take three, mm-hmm, or you don't get it at all. Which I guess that kind of sets us up for the conflict of Chronicler baiting and holding Quoth's, the actual telling, and Quoth getting his story on record,
mm-hmm,
hostage. Which is an interesting note because it's the same thing he does to Falurian.
Yeah.
It's a device that's used a couple times. That you don't get, your story won't actually get known unless you let me go.
Right.
So we get the introduction of Chronicler, who basically says, oh my, it actually is you. I didn't think it would be, but the things they say about your hair are true.
Yeah, why wouldn't he dye it? You'd think he'd know enough alchemy by now that he'd be able to come up with some bleach or something.
I mean, you would, but Quoth knows nothing about alchemy.
No, I know, but at this point...
He's not an arcanist.
I understand.
I'm not trying to be intentionally obtuse. I just think they've set it up as such.
I just don't understand why he hasn't disguised himself better. That's my point.
Well, I feel like we have enough of his character developed to know that he's way too proud not to secretly be full on, like, no, I'm Quoth. I've always been Quoth. I am Quoth. Like that's what he's getting baited into, right? Like, that's what Bast is trying to get him to just be. And I feel like that's kind of, like, if not the natural intention of the story, it's obviously very much Bast's intention.
True.
And so, and Quoth does not strike me as the kind of person who's just going to lose that sense of pride that he's, like, known for, right? Like, all the side characters, like, even in Slow Regard, Ari is, like, makes a side thought comment of, like, oh no, he's way too proud for that. Way too proud
that's,
for that.
Yeah, that's
just
a good point.
Like, okay.
Yes, and especially with the way that Quoth opens the story, ending with the phrase, you may have heard of me.
Yeah.
Like, it just drips
right. So
much
arrogance. Yeah, because when
he's a showman, right?
Yes.
Like, that's who he is at heart. So he's gonna do those silly little, like, he wants someone to figure it out. He does.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
Which is also probably why he straight up tells Aaron at that one point. Well, and to try and save Aaron's life, like he says, but it's just like, dude, you're not as humble as you want to play it.
No. Here.
Like, if you want, I do have that page open. I can read it just as a...
Oh, you just happen to have that page open?
I do, in fact.
It just happened to go digging for that particular thing.
But, so, like, my name is Quoth. It's pronounced nearly the same as Quoth. Names are important as they tell a great deal about a person. I've had more names than anyone has a right to. The Edem called me Maedra, which, depending on how it's spoken, can mean the flame, the thunder, or the broken tree. The flame is obvious if you've ever seen me. I have red hair. Bright. If I had been born a couple hundred years earlier, I probably would have been burned as a demon. I keep it short, but it's unruly. When left to its own devices, it sticks up and makes me look as if I've been set afire. The thunder I attribute to a strong baritone and a great deal of stage training at an early age. I never thought of the broken tree is very significant, although in retrospect, I suppose it could be considered at least partially prophetic. My first mentor called me Ilir because I was clever and I knew it. My first real lover called me Dulitr because she liked the way it sounded. I have been called Shadakar, Lightfinger, and Sixstring. I have been called Quoth the Bloodless, Quoth the Arcane, and Quoth Kingkiller. I have earned those names, bought and paid for them. But I was brought up Quoth. My father once told me it meant to know. I have, of course, been called many other things, many of them uncouth, although very few were unearned. I have stolen princesses back from sleeping Barrow kings. I've burned down the town of Traben. I spent the night with Falurian and left with both my sanity and my life. I was expelled from the university at a younger age than most people are allowed in. I tread paths by moonlight that others fear to walk during the day. I have talked to gods, loved women, and written songs that make the minstrels weep. You may have heard of me.
Dear Lord.
So,
I forgot how insufferable that was.
It really is. I actually told Ashley the first time she read this book. So this is the 10th anniversary edition. This page lands on page 55. I was like, if you get to the end of that section and aren't at least a little bit intrigued, stop reading.
Mm-hmm.
Because you will not enjoy it if you don't get a little bit of a, okay, I need to see where this goes.
Right.
But we also, even in this, and the reason why I'm bringing this up, because ironically, we've just gotten to the Waystone and we're very close to time. So we get some hooks that are set that even at the end of book two, we don't have answers to. And so I just want to highlight them. I've stolen princesses back from sleeping Barrow kings. We have no idea what that's referring to. And there are only a few princesses mentioned. We know about Traben. We know about Falurian. We know that he's expelled from the university. We have no idea why. Tread paths by... Go ahead.
I just thought of this here, and I'm trying to remember the exact context, but wasn't he... one of the situations when he ended up on the Horns, did he get expelled and then reinstated instantly? Or like the masters like voted him out, and then they turned around and voted him right back in?
So they...
And it was the whole...
They voted that he was... To be, yeah, basically they voted to convict him and then immediately voted to withhold and strike expulsion as a punishment because of his, that was his entrance into the Arcanum.
It's probably just wishful thinking on my part because I'm really going to be annoyed at the part where he does something stupid and gets expelled. At this point, just with the way things progress, probably because the university is my favorite part. Like, I just want him to be there forever.
Yeah.
And I kind of want that to be the fulfillment of that particular piece, is he's just playing coy and being like, I was expelled. Sure, I was reinstated 10 seconds later, but I was expelled, you know, kind of thing. Anyway, carry on.
Yeah. I have tread paths by moonlight that others fear to walk during the day. We don't necessarily, though, that could be a nod to Falurian, but we've already mentioned Falurian.
You can't walk a path by moonlight in the daylight, bro.
Correct.
I'm just saying, we're not afraid of s***. It's just, you can't do it.
I think, generally speaking, the roads are being referred to by moonlight. Or paths, meaning like walking paths.
If you consider that moonlight is just a reflection of sunlight, then isn't it all moonlight walking by daylight?
Depends on if the moon is in the sky or not.
I'm going to catch so much hell for that later. She's going to kill me for even saying that.
No. I'm just going to point out the fact that the moon does in fact leave the sky and goes somewhere, and even the Fae talk about stealing a piece of the moon. We don't know who has the moon. We don't know where she's being kept.
Yeah,
we don't know
dude.
If she's being kept in a box that very few people know how to open. And it sounds like
okay,
there's something in.
How many things can we fit in this freaking box? Because we've theorized the Skrail. We've theorized the moon now. I wouldn't be freaking surprised.
Tamerlan's in there.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if Quoth himself is like, oh, the Waystone Inn, that's the box.
That actually wasn't the box I was referring to.
I know it's not the box you were referring to. I am being hyperbolic for effect.
Just saying, Melu and Lachlis's box sounds like something's moving, but it doesn't. They can't necessarily to a point, like, they can't tell if something's moving. Huh. I wonder if it's a tangible piece of moon.
Why would that be your first thought?
Because it's a box that there's no seam on. There's a box that there's old magic written on that you can't see or decipher, and there's no way to get into it, and it seems like it has to be magically open. Sounds an awful lot like the box that's described in the story where he steals a piece of the moon.
But also, like, how do you... Like,
what did the moon do? Maybe the moon deserved
it. Like,
I don't know.
A weird,
there's a lot of dark forces that have been unleashed. What? And imagine if the moon is actually let out of her box and decides, I'm coming for everybody because I've been stuck in this box for 1,000 years.
So the moon is everything that's inside of Pandora's box.
Yeah.
Like, Pandora opens her box and it's just like, haha, I'm the moon, suckers.
Yeah, and that's how we get currents, I guess.
Just, oh no, everything is awful. The ocean rises and falls. Whatever shall we do with this tragedy?
But that actually is going to bring us pretty much close to time. So we have now made it to the Waystone. Quoth has done his dramatic introduction to Chronicler. And we have begun the story of book one. Thoughts before we close out today?
Profound, thought-provoking, just incredibly insightful, Ashley.
Look, I've gotten tweets that people are enjoying this, so you're just hang with me.
I'm really glad that they have confirmed for you personally and didn't care to let Kyle and I in on the fact that they're enjoying this.
To be fair, it was to our MinMax Twitter account, if my memory is correct, but still, we have friends confirming that they're enjoying the series. But Mampersands, if you're enjoying the series, we would also love to hear from you. MinMaxPod@gmail.com, MinMaxPod at all the socials except Reddit.com/u/MinMaxPodcast, 773-789-9369 is the voicemail number for voicemails 3 minutes or less. Anything longer than that, you can record an audio file and send it over to the email address. I'm at Alan H. Mowers on Twitter. Ashley's at DEDE_K. Kyle is at Stainbrook Kyle. And unless we have any more thoughts, we'll see you guys next week.